Welcome. Thank you very much for being here. This is exciting to be back in person, live. This is my first time in South By. I had no clue how big it is. And it's amazing to be here. And I'm joined by Will Page, who is a legend in his own right, chief economist of Spotify and PRS for Music. And I'm sure he'll do a much better introduction of himself than I ever can. My name is Farhan. I'm the founder and CEO for Sare, which is building the digital ecosystem for South Asian classical music. Our app and website, Sare Music, is live. And today I'll be sharing more about my journey, about South Asian classical music, about Sare Music, and then Will has some amazing stats on niche streaming that he'll be sharing as well. Will, would you like to add something?
Yeah, great to be here. This is a fascinating topic. I think as we reach the point where there's 100 million songs on streaming services, the question of is that too much choice and how do you work through that level of choice is a pertinent one. So to be discussing niche streaming at the same time as we have 100 million songs is going to be a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. Who here has seen Black Panther? And I'm sure everybody is familiar with Vibranium. So niche music today is like Vibranium. There's an incredible treasure trove out there which people want to have access to, but don't, because the generalists are focusing on everything else except for those niche genres of music that are out there, and really it's a treasure trove that the world wants to listen to. And for South Asian classical music, you would imagine niche would be small. There are 125 million people worldwide who love the genre, but just don't have easy access to it. And it's continuing to grow. It's been growing since I've been monitoring it, since two, three years ago. Initially, I saw 32 million, went up to 42 million, went up to 70 million, went up to 93 million, and now it's 125. So the growth is incredible. And this is really driven by the fact that there are a growing number of people in the digital world who previously didn't have access to the internet, but now do, and they're looking for something that they can really relate to. And it's actually spread worldwide. So you would imagine South Asian classical music would be restricted to South Asia, and this is something Will and I will be talking about later as well. But it's really worldwide, even in places like all the way to Indonesia, and then all the way to Brazil, which was very surprising for us when we found out. So there's something about music that crosses boundaries and touches people's lives.
If I may just quickly add a point onto that, one of the questions we used to ask at Spotify before we launched in India, it's a clever question, it was, could we break an Indian artist even though Spotify is not in India? Because we had the data to see where that Indian repertoire was being consumed, the city level data. Could we target those cities with a large Indian diaspora to break Indian artists, even though we weren't in the country, and just extend on niche streaming and how music travels? We looked at Korea. It took a long time before Spotify launched in Korea, but K-pop was the number one repertoire that we worked in Southeast Asia. And the number one city for listening to K-pop was Lima in Peru, and that was on record. So it just helps you think about the amazing charity Doctors Without Borders, who unfortunately are very busy at the moment, but I call it Playlists Without Borders. This niche music is A, a pretty big niche, and B, it can travel.
Thank you. So my story in South Asian classical music and Sare Music actually started in Hong Kong. So this is, you can see through the window, that's Telegraph Bay in Hong Kong. I was sitting in my hotel room at the Le Meridien, and I wanted to listen to some Pakistani classical music. So I went on your YouTube and your Spotify and I said, I'm sure that's there. And even though I tried to look for it, and even though, I really tried, I could hardly find anything good, of good quality, and I knew that there's incredible music out there. So why is it not there on the streaming services? And my story on Sire Music actually starts 2 years before that day in Hong Kong. And it actually started in London. I was at London Business School's Sammy Offer Center in a 10 by 10 space. And I was talking to Ustad Shehbaz Hussain. Now, Ustad Shehbaz Hussain is one of the leading tabla players in the world at this time. Absolutely fantastic. For those who don't know what the tabla is, it's a hand-played percussion instrument. And you can see it. He's leaning on that instrument there. I was talking to him on the phone. He lives in Rochdale. I was in London at the time. And he said, there are people out there who want to listen to this. But at this time, there is nothing available for people to be able to access it. And he said to me that it is your responsibility to do something about this. So that was at the back of my mind when I was in Hong Kong. And the reason that he said that this is your responsibility is that my story really starts at the All Pakistan Music Conference in Lahore, Pakistan. Now, the All Pakistan Music Conference is an organization that was started in 1959 by my grandfather. He started it because one of the greatest classical artists that was from Pakistan, but one of the greatest classical artists for South Asia, went on national radio and said she's going to stop singing because nobody listens to the music. And my grandfather was really shocked. He's like, I'm not going to let this happen. I know there are people out there. So he set up an organization, put up an event in Lahore. It was a huge success. And now, the All Pakistan Music Conference has a concert of music every month and a 5-day annual festival. Over 150 artists come and perform on the stage. The audience is incredible. It's a one-of-a-kind event. It's a single-stage event, but it's absolutely incredible. And so I have grown up listening to this music. And I have seen firsthand how this really enriches people's lives. And it really gets... It has very little language to it in terms of, you know, it's Urdu or Hindi or English or Punjabi. Very few words in there. But the language of the music is just amazing. So with that background, with Ustad Shehbaz Hussain then saying to me, that's your responsibility. And then that kind of moment in Hong Kong where I kind of realized that there's this incredible opportunity to give people access to this music, to actually start making a difference in the artists' lives. Because if there is something that I can do to connect the artists with the people who want to listen to them, it's going to change the industry. And so that's how Sire Music came to be born. So it's going to be the digital ecosystem for the genre. And the first part of this is a music streaming service where users can access unlimited, exclusive content that's not available anywhere else via an auto-recurring subscription after an initial free trial period. This is one of the... So what you heard there was a sitar performance. And ever since we've launched, we've just continued to grow. In February, we had 7 million listens. Now I know compared to the big boys and the Spotify's and the YouTubes, it is still very small. But just the fact that so many people are actually listening to this is testament to the fact that people want, there are people out there who want this niche genre of music. One of the gems that we've discovered through this, and when I talked about the artists and how they've started to benefit, one of the gems is Noorzehra Kazem. Now, she is well into her 70s. She has been playing this instrument called the Sagar Veena. And for those who know a little about South Asian classical music, this instrument is a modern Pakistani version of the ancient Veena. It's very much a modern instrument. She's the only one in the world who plays it. She's not a professional musician. She does it just because she loves it. So we had her recordings, and like everything else, we put this up, and we discovered that the world actually loves listening to her. It is very calming, it is very peaceful, and it fills you with a sense of an immense tranquility. And we never knew this. So that's one of the things that we've discovered through Sara Music. She was trending number one last year on Sara Music. Since we've grown, I'm just going to throw out a couple of interesting stats. Our monthly active users month on month have grown 58% in the last 3 months. And since we've launched, we've grown 26% since December 2019. Not to say we didn't have challenges in the beginning. We definitely did. Our initial growth was pretty slow. But as we've been able to refine the streaming service, as we've been able to make it more relevant and make it easy for people to access the music and actually deliver to them what they're looking for, we've seen our monthly active users go up. And you wouldn't imagine, we only have 1.4% churn, which is the average for the last 3 months. In some months, we've had 0.2% churn. Again, in the beginning, our churn was 50%, 40%. But as, again, we started to refine our service and our model and how we're delivering the content and what we're showing, we've seen these numbers come down. We've been also very lucky that we won first prize at the Columbia Venture Competition in New York. And in, I said US, I thought we had icons there. But anyways, we won that in New York, and in September, we won first place Columbia Venture Competition, sorry. We were selected as the Createch Wants to Watch 2021 by the UK Creative Industries Council.
Fantastic.
The industry is also moving very excitingly. We're going to talk more about how Primephonic, which was a Western classical music app, has been acquired by Apple Music. Anghami is an app for music streaming, which is Middle Eastern music. That is doing much better than Spotify across the Middle East. That they just did an IPO on the NASDAQ in 2021. And really, what all of this really shows is that it's really about access for the artists to have access to the listeners, and for people who want to listen to it to have access to this. And it's really creating an opportunity for the artists and the industry to an underserved and underrepresented community to actually start becoming self-sustainable. So thank you for listening, and we have some interesting discussion points on the broader industry that Will and I will be discussing.
Absolutely, fantastic presentation. Quite riveting to think, you know, in this niche, you can find scale. And this is a big topic, it really matters. And to arch this conversation, I want to go back to your story about niche music from Spotify around about 2014, 2015, where because we had launched in the Netherlands and Holland very early, because we had scaled in that country very early, we deployed local curators very early. So it was our first non-Scandinavian market to have local curation who worked with Dutch language hip hop. And by 2018, we noticed this. Drake was the biggest artist on Spotify worldwide. In Holland, he was the eighth biggest hip hop artist, and the seven above him were Dutch rappers rapping in Dutch. So it tells you it can be done. And to your point, I want you to think in economic terms here of demand not being met with supply, which is your story from Hong Kong, then how supply can create demand. How do you build America? You supply the train line, people demand the houses. So this is a very interesting story of demand and supply. Now, for Niche Music, to kind of as an icebreaker, we got some exclusive stats to share with you. There's a beautiful website called Every Noise at Once, built by Glenn McDonald from the Echo Nest. It has 5,781 genres and an open API that you can plug into to understand genres. The most recent genre is contemporary Polish military marching music, 5,781 genres, big genre. So I worked with him to try and understand what is the future of niche music. So follow me when I say this. So the share of streams coming from the top five genres in the world, that is global pop, hip-hop, rock, EDM, and Latin, has declined every year for the last 4 years, from 38.5% down to 35.9%, down to 33.1%, down to 30.3%. So just to recap, streaming has got bigger, and the share of the top four genres has got smaller. That tells you a lot. And if I want to broaden it out to the top 100 genres, well, that share too has fallen from 71.3% all the way down to 63.9%. Again, streaming has got bigger, but the share of the head in genre terms has got smaller. So there's definitely opportunity. Really exciting to think about how that could play out. But let's just come back to choice. I have this expression in music, which is the music industry is clearly making more money. We're going to learn about that next week with the new IFPI numbers. But it's got way more mouths to feed. There's way more choice. Today, I would estimate there is 87,000 songs being ingested onto streaming services, competing for the attention for the 87,000 that were released yesterday. That's more volume than was released in a calendar year in the 80s or the early 90s. So Barry Schwartz, the author of The Paradox of Choice, has this beautiful way of saying, some choice is better than none, but it doesn't necessarily follow that more is better than some. Do you think that what you're doing with niche music streaming, and there's other niche platforms here in the audience today, is answering that question, that there is just too much choice for the consumer to navigate, and rather than go into a small fish in a big pool, it's better to come and be a big fish in a small pool, like with Sari Music?
Great question. I'm not sure whether the big fish in a small pool would be relevant, but when I was doing my MBA, one of my professors, and we're very lucky to have her as a professor, was Sheena Iyengar. She's one of the top 50 business thinkers in the world. She was on on the list in one of the years it was published. Her main research is on choice and how people make choice. And she discovered that if you present people with more than three things, what happens is cognitive overload. And then it becomes very difficult for people to make a decision. Now, that may be in play, but I'm not quite sure whether that is the scenario with, you know, with a Spotify or a YouTube. I think what's actually happening there is because of two things. One is all music is being viewed from a Western lens. So because of that, the way you structure the music and the way you structure the presentation of the music becomes different. And number two is they're obviously looking at all the genres, mm-hmm. right? I mean, 5,000 plus genres is crazy. And so they have to structure the entire business around a generalist approach. And when you have both of those things in play, what happens is that the nuances of the genre become lost. Mm-hmm. And so you see that in other places as well, where you have specialist services or specialist apps starting to do maybe not as well as the Spotify's of the world, but still starting to get significant market share in that niche and actually creating their own market in that. So I think, yes, the cognitive overload, the paradox of choice might be there, but I think it's more than that.
And you mentioned earlier about language, and I want to raise that as well. Back to how global streaming services perhaps don't serve niche markets. It's well known that many of the biggest streaming services launched in Japan with English curation. Bit of a faux pas. Any surprise why you didn't scale? language is crucial. And I can remember when we were launching Spotify in India, we had to fathom there was 11 relevant languages we needed to customize for. Otherwise, this wasn't going to fly. And we weren't ready to, you know, curate any of those 11. So it's a huge mountain to climb. Now, if you think about the role of language and niche music streaming services, do you think you're better equipped to address the language question in curation vis-a-vis a company headquartered in Los Angeles or Stockholm?
Well, great question. I think for us, at least for South Asian classical music, the language is not a barrier at all. Mm-hmm. Because like I mentioned, the music itself is based very much on notes themselves and not necessarily the words being used. And so it's just about, it's about losing yourself in the music, in the notes that are being used. Now, the interesting thing with South Asian classical music, Pakistani or Indian classical music, is that the notes that have been developed and are being used are specific to certain times of day.
Mm-hmm.
So the rag is what I'm talking about. There's a morning rag, and there are afternoon rags, and there are evening rags. So the day is divided into different times of day. And the reason it's that is there is because those notes are supposed to resonate with your soul at that time of day. And then you have rags which are for seasons. So you would have rags for the rain.
That'd be very useful in Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have two seasons in Scotland, winter and June, so, you know.
And so because it's so much based on the notes themselves, the language barrier, at least for our genre of music, is not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is why you probably, you know, the map that I showed of the world where people are listening to this, that is probably why it's there. And you can lose yourself in the music without worrying about what they're saying.
I want to come back to a question which is really anchored in the make or buy question. So going back to that choice question, if I think about consumers and just buying food, very simple example, would you buy your meat and fish in a supermarket, or would you go to a specialist butcher and fishmonger to serve you that, you know, it could be dietary requirements, it could be religious issues, but do you go to the generalist, the supermarket, or do you go to the butchers and the fishmongers who are the specialists? And I think one of the values of the specialist is you pay that premium because they've searched to get you the best meat and the best fish into your kitchen for cooking. And I think you can take that parable and apply it to music, which is when you saw Apple as your beautiful presentation illustrated acquiring Primephonic, I can tell you that genres like classical and jazz are really underrepresented within streaming companies. You know, I am a huge jazz fan. I don't think there's any jazz curation happening at Spotify in 2022. That company is now 15 years old. It's a bit of a scandal. So do you see Apple, Spotify, Amazon, YouTube buying more specialist companies? Or do you think the specialist companies like yourself will be standalone entities and are better just carving out your own niche as opposed to being swallowed up by a big giant?
Well, I don't know how this will actually play out, but I think that even if the big generalists do jump into buying out these companies or investing in these companies, it would do them well to keep them as separate brands altogether, because of the following that these brands and the way these brands are structured and the way at least our service is structured. Mm-hmm. It would do well for the Spotify's or the Apple Music's of the world to actually keep it separate, even if they do make an investment.
And this is a live debate in music as well. Just to give you an example, Spotify has merged podcasts with music into one app, whereas Apple made a decision, we're going to keep them separate. In other words, you can imagine the internal debate inside both companies about which horse do you want to back. On reflection, I think Apple's got it right, because podcasts are reasonably clearly curated here, and music's really clearly curated there. And if that is right, I'm not calling it the winner here, but if that is right, having a company like Apple acquire a company like yours, but having it as a separate standalone app with their branding, might be the sweet spot in terms of that balance between niche and generalist. Almost like take the specialist butcher and house that specialist butcher inside the supermarket with their own branding.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to quickly turn to the opportunity there. You looked at the numbers, and I want to open this question up with an anecdote that I love telling about Spotify's launch in India. We were getting ready for launching in India, and we had one person on the ground in India, Akshat Harbla. Google employs 16,000 people in India at the time. We had one person. And I asked a very reasonable question for the chief economist to ask, which is, how many students are in India? You know, we have student pricing, we have student marketing, there's a willingness to pay for education, there's not a willingness to pay for media, which is interesting. So how many students are in India? It's a reasonable question to ask. And his answer went like this. Very good question. Your answer is either 100 million or 200 million. And I went back to a colleague in the Indian government and said, this idiot's given me this answer of there are either 100 million or 200 million students in India. And my friend said, your colleague is perfectly right. You can be plus or minus 100 million in your estimates and still keep your job. But if you look at a stat like that and you look at the niche that you're dealing with, if you get this right, how big could this niche become?
Great question. You know, like I shared, there's now 125 million people around the world who specifically love this genre in the digital world.
Yeah.
And just to put it into a little context.
It's crazy. We have five people curating Dutch language hip hop for a country of 80 million.
Yeah.
And we have nobody curating classical music for Southeast Asia. And you're bouncing around numbers of 125 million.
Yeah. I mean, thank you for that number. I mean, I wanted to put it into context here as well. So the population of Texas is around 30 million.
Yeah.
The population in the UK is around 65 million, I believe. 65 or 70 million?
5 million are Scottish.
Scottish.
And we've got 50 million sheep.
All right. And so you can imagine the number of people out there and the scope of this market. It's immense.
What about the migration point? I mentioned earlier about how music can travel beyond borders. There's stats which estimate between 40 to 50, 60 million Indians in the diaspora around the world. How do you look at the export opportunity for classical music that's coming from, let's say, Pakistan? Do you see, A, there's a home market strategy, and B, there's an overseas market strategy, and you work them, you know, hand in hand?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, for Sari music in specific, I mean, yes, we're being listened to in South Asia. No surprise there. But then there's the Middle East, and there's the UK and the US. Again, no surprises there. These are where South Asian expats generally tend to live. But we've been downloaded in 119 countries. That's ridiculous. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Pakistan now wants to do a collaborative effort with us to be able to bring Pakistani music to the world through their missions around the world as well. So there's definitely a lot there which crosses boundaries. Music, I mean, I know you did some work with Playlists Without Boundaries. You know, it's no surprise that, and everybody knows that music has no boundaries. We always hear that. And we see that with South Asian, Pakistani classical music as well.
And where you find those niche markets, we're not referring to countries anymore. We have the city-level data. And if you have city-level data, refer to cities. So I can just share one story to capture this from the genre of rock. In 2015, I was tasked with making sure we got the new Radiohead album on Spotify. And of course, Radiohead had said some rather disparaging remarks around Spotify a few years earlier. And I presented the case to the band that we had all this data that you could use. And their response was, we don't need your data. And I said, well, we have the top city-level data. We know where our top cities are. Okay then, Little Tom and Big Johnny, where are your top cities? It's obvious. It's London, Glasgow, Manchester, Amsterdam, Paris, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago. It's where we do our stadiums. That's our top cities. And it took 35 seconds to open an Apple Mac computer and show that their number one city was Santiago, Chile. Five of their top six cities were in Latin America. Lima was number three. I forgot we licensed in Peru. And the journalist who reported this, I told this to a journalist off record, and she broke the cardinal rule in journalism and actually put it on record. At the end, she said, since interviewing Will Page, I have noticed that Radiohead have started adding Latin American tour dates to their global tour. So where the fuck is my 20%? But it's really, really important to think about, if you have city-level data, do not refer to countries. Go granular, and there will be cities that will be responsive to your niche repertoire that you can start to work a strategy around, be it touring, be it marketing.
That's a great point. Yeah, absolutely.
I thought it'd be interesting to pose a challenge for you, which is we debate to death in Britain at least, the streaming model. We call it the pro rata share business of, if you get 1% of all the streams in Britain in 1 month, you get 1% of all the money. It's that simple. But it's not duration based. Hence, two things are happening with songwriting. Songs are getting shorter and the course is moving to the front. Why would you write longer songs when you're not incentivized to do so? Classical typically is longer in length, in composition length. Do you think that models should accommodate this with duration-based compensation? I know this is a little bit technical, but how about a song that is performed over 13 minutes gets the same as a skit by Drake, which lasted 41 seconds? Do you think that challenge needs to be addressed for niche music to thrive?
Absolutely, that's a great point. Just to give some context, the average Western track length is about 3 minutes, three and a half minutes. The average track for Pakistani classical music is 25 minutes. And we have performances and tracks on Sara Music which go on to close to 90 minutes. So it's a complete...
And that 90-minute composition gets the same half penny as a 41-second skit by Drake.
In your normal...
Good luck paying for your bus fares.
Exactly. So we actually, before we started Sara Music... we actually tried putting out this music on the big streaming, you know, on Spotify and Apple Music's out there. Exactly what you're saying. We saw that even though there was demand, even though people were listening, it made absolutely no money. There was a startling statistic that I saw on LinkedIn that less than 1%, or was it maybe 0.5% of the artists in the UK make a living from streaming. I didn't go research that in detail, but if that is true, that is really startling. And so, to make it more equitable, yes, for the big streaming services, that definitely needs to change. Mm-hmm. The way we're handling it is slightly different. Because this is still... these artists have never had exposure in the digital world. What we're doing is we're first and foremost giving them that exposure. So, like I mentioned, Noor Zehra Kazim, she is now loved worldwide. People want to now starting inviting her to events worldwide. Her entire 70 years of her life, she was never invited anywhere because people never knew about her. And so that is one of the things that we're doing with Sara Music, is being... providing the artists the opportunity to share their work with the world. And what we're going to be doing as we're building out the ecosystem is first adding this feature called the Nazrana. And for those who are not familiar with the language, a Nazrana is a very respectable form of a tip that you give, or an appreciation payment that you give to artists.
Wow.
And that's a very deep part of South Asian culture, where when the artist performs something that has moved your soul, you will walk up to the artist and actually present money at the artist's feet. So, which is why I'm very careful to call it Nazrana and not call it, you know, an appreciation payment, because it's even more than that. And so we're going to be enabling that through the app. So people around the world who are listening to it can at that time send an instant payment to the artist who really should be getting it, deserve it, and then the listener who wants to really do that.
I'm conscious of time. How much time do we have left? I have a clock here, but
we have time.
25 minutes. Great.
So
I want to take some Q&A, but the last question I had for you was just, Spotify has been in Pakistan for a year, almost a year to the day, it's the anniversary. Other companies are there too. When you look at the competition, what advice would you give them? It's kind of a contrarian question to ask you, but what advice would you give them about how things should be done differently? When you look at who's there, I give the example earlier of, you know, streaming services launching in Japan with only English language curation. I mean, what mistakes are you seeing being made by these large companies?
You know, I can only look at this from the outside because I don't have data on what's actually going on in Spotify Pakistan. So I can't speak about it from that side. But from where I see, I think they're making the same mistake that they've been making elsewhere. They're approaching it with a Western lens. They're not curating the experience, not just the music, but the experience from a local standpoint. And I think if they fix that, then they actually might have challenge with the other genres. And so, like I said before, I think where they are and where their how their business is structured, I don't think they can make much of a change. But if I were to be in their shoes and looking at it from the outside, I would say they just need to make it more localized and more relevant.
More boots on the ground, potentially.
More boots on the ground, absolutely.
Interesting. Let's see if we have any questions here. We have a mic on the middle. Please do. And questions on Sari's business, as well as anything I can do to help on wider questions about global niche markets.
Hi there. My name's Presley. Mm-hmm. So your genre is very niche, and the company has a lot of artists or songs. I'm just wondering, how did you find them? If they're so niche and they're not on Apple Music, Spotify, and all that, how do you curate and find them?
Great question. Thank you. Thank you for the question. So, you know, my background has been with the All Pakistan Music Conference, like I mentioned. And so I've grown up listening to this music. The platform that my grandfather started and my mother runs, and I'm a part of the executive committee, has over 125, 150 artists perform on the stage every year. So for me, it was very normal. I have access to the artists. I know the artists. I've been listening to them since I've been growing up. And so it wasn't difficult at all. But I can completely understand where you're coming from, and which is why we're actually doing this, is because we want to give these people a platform where people like you and others out there can actually discover them.
A quick follow-up, if you plan to incorporate other niche genres, would you hire a team to seek those artists out?
Great question. So our platform is actually set up to... So when I say Pakistani classical music or South Asian classical music, it's actually a catch-all phrase and an umbrella genre, really, because even in that, there are about over a dozen genres there. And so we can definitely incorporate that. But that is a great question. The same thing that I'm saying, if we were to, we would need to hire people for that, and that would make most sense, because otherwise we'd be making the same mistake that Spotify is making of looking at it from the outside rather than building it from within.
Wow.
Thank you.
And just to add to your question, that raises a debate about should you have a separate app for those new inclusions, which, you know, that's a big question. Call that one wrong and you're nosediving pretty fast. But I think there's a case for having separate apps for separate genres.
Thank you so much.
Great questions. That's a 10 as questions go.
Hi, first of all, super inspiring. I love the journey and everything, but I really wanted to ask, kind of from the subscription, how do the royalties get distributed to the artists?
In Spotify or Sari Music?
In Sari.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. So, like I said, the way we are structured is slightly different. These artists have been... So, let me bring you back to the genre itself. The genre is predominantly in the public domain. So, when I mentioned rag, a rag is a composition or a set of notes which is hundreds, if not thousands, of years old. And so when you would hear a rag Shri or a rag Bhairvi or a rag Bhopali done thousands of times by hundreds of different artists. And so that's in the public domain. So the only thing that can really have copyrights and where an artist can claim, let's say, payment is for the improvisation right or the performance rights. Mm-hmm. Now, traditionally in this genre in Pakistan, these artists are paid for their performance, and that's it. Nothing gets recorded most of the time. Nothing gets, you know, published 90% of the time until now. Now Sari Music is providing that platform where they're being heard around the world. And so we are not making the mistake or the streaming mistake that Spotify is making in terms of doing that, but we're finding alternate ways of actually making sure the artists get compensated, because at the end of the day, it's the artists who are creating that work. If they're no artists, if they're not being paid, if they're not making a living, then the music disappears. And really, this is also not just an exercise in access, it's also an exercise in preservation, which is where I actually started this. But I don't like to approach it from there, because I'm an optimist, and I want to always look at what we can do, which will make a difference in the world, rather than just be looking at, we need to save this somehow. I want to save it, and I want to make it thrive, which is why we're doing Sorry Music.
I see. Thanks so much.
If I can just quickly add to your question there, another fantastic question. I love hearing you talk. It's so inspiring. But there's a paper, and particularly for students in this room, that we published called Money In, Money Out. I published it with David Safir, which looked at how money comes into a business is one question. How you allocate and distribute that money is another. And I just think there is room for maneuver within streaming today to move away from this current, I don't think you're allowed to say the word communism here in the United States, I'll say socialistic model, where every song is worth the same. If you were upstairs listening to Bill Gurley earlier today, he quoted me when I said, why does whale music, the sound of whales, get paid the same as Taylor Swift's new album? For me, there's a tension there, and that tension is likely to snap over the years. But for a niche streaming platform, you can address it differently. For example, very quick example, ASCAP has time of day weighting based on music. Guess what? Music played during peak time gets paid more than music played when you're asleep. And you referred earlier to time of day as the importance of classical music from South Asia. There could be a role for that. So a wider question here about experimenting with different ways to allocate and distribute what is essentially a fixed pot of cash.
Super interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Ruth Kaleva. Love hearing you speak. It's beautiful. I come from originally from an underrepresented region on all the major platforms. So I come from the Balkan region, and Spotify and Apple Music do not have local representation in pretty much all the countries. So we're approximately 10 countries in the region with population close to, I guess, 100 million. And world music, Balkan music, which is sort of, I put it in the same pond as South Asian music, classical music. So the Balkan genre is part of the whole world music collective, right? And what I'm kind of hearing from you makes sense, that sort of niche DSPs can work very well for world music. You know, in every single continent, region has their own specialty, and that's in a large sense, not small catalogs. But how can niche music work for other genres as well, which are not part of the world music pond? So crossover genres, jazz, pop, soul, funk, which you mentioned that are underrepresented on Spotify. And I think this is a major issue with the leading DSPs. But my other question was, what would happen if there are so many DSPs that the consumer just cannot choose what to use? Thank you.
Would you like to take a stab at that?
Again, these questions give me goosebumps. This is a tricky one. But one thing I would point out there, just to come into your question, is just to make the observation, which is, when it comes to eyeballs, video streaming, we are willing to pay for Netflix, Disney Plus, BBC license fee in the UK, Hulu. We pay for more than one. Whereas in music, ear holes, we only pay for one. So the interesting challenge here is, if it's $9.99 and it has been $9.99 now for 20 years in sterling, euro, and dollar, very few businesses have not raised prices in 20 years. Music seems to. It's been $9.99, and we say, all I want from you is £9.99 and not a penny more, and you get everything. And that's another straitjacket the business, a very successful music business, has found itself in. And how do you get out of that straitjacket envelopes the question about how to embrace music from your region, the Balkans. If I can just build one other observation there, you will be familiar with the Exit Festival.
Yeah, I worked with them.
Yeah. So yeah. I learned 1 year that the Exit Festival had something like 80,000 people there, of which 60,000 people came from Britain to see Jarvis Cocker perform Common People at the Exit Festival. Now, national pride kicks in, isn't that great? But then you can reverse the question and say, well, why aren't 80,000 people traveling to the Exit Festival to experience music from the Balkans? And that's a question of trade balance as well, like deficits and surpluses, of just, you know, is British music overpopulating the Balkans with its festival culture and suffocating the chance for local music to be recognized? I'm interested in that balancing act as well.
There's a big portion of inequality within the European Union of how Balkan and Eastern European country members are represented within the culture and in music environment within Europe. But that's a different topic.
Can I just clarify, is Spotify licensed in Croatia now?
In Croatia, I think it is. But yeah. There's no country curators in any other countries.
Yeah.
So Serbia, Macedonia, Albania, Kosovo, Bulgaria. I think they have one person in Romania because it's a larger market within the Europop's genre.
Just a quick anecdote and then we'll move on to the next question. But I remember the president of the European Commission, to which Scotland used to be a member of, we would like to get back. But I remember him saying Spotify is available in all European countries. I had to quickly tap him on the shoulder like, we forgot to license in Croatia. So.
No, but I'd like to add to that. I'm glad you brought up the term world music. I am quite against that term. Because again...
thing you can guarantee about the term world music is everybody hates it. But we still use it.
Don't know how to call it.
It's the same thing that I was saying. I mean, it's viewed from a Western lens. And imagine, you know, if you had all of the genres that you mentioned, you know, jazz and hip-hop and rap and metal and... you know, reggae or whatever, all of those genres were only called Western music. You would never be able to get the richness, understand the richness of every single genre.
Yeah.
And that's what, when viewed from a Western lens, world music is. So, you know, I'm also only talking about South Asian classical music, but Balkan music, and I'm sure Celtic music and Middle Eastern music and amazing genres in African music. There's an incredible richness in the music that we have in the world. Not world music, in world music, in the music that we have in the world. And that is not being justice. The major streaming services are not doing justice to that. And so the learnings that we have, to your question about how can we translate what we've learned from Sari music onto the other streaming services or other genres, is that, you know, I would say the same thing. You are the best person to understand what the nuances of the genre are. And so you should be building something up from the inside out. And I think that will inherently find success.
I love that comment, inside
Thank
out.
Thank you.
Lovely question. And just a quick clarification on Celtic music. I grew up next to Edinburgh Castle and I'd happily pay $9.99 a month to never hear the fucking bagpipes again. It'd do my head in, especially with a hangover. Next question.
Hey guys, it's been real refreshing to hear you both today. My name is Brandon Bailey. So I own an artist management company since 2008, but I also am a lead executive for a niche DSP out of the United States. And so one of the two things, I'd love to connect with you afterwards, because most of our development team's in Lahore, Pakistan, funny
nice.
Enough.
Wow.
Yeah,
nice.
It is. Small world. But also, would you think as a lead executive for a niche DSP, do you feel that your consumer, our consumers in this global space should pay less than a DSP like Spotify?
Great question. You're the economist. I mean, I can, but why don't you...
The rational way of approaching this is you're being offered less, a fraction of the 100 million songs on Spotify, therefore you should pay less. But I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I believe in signaling. And if you signal to the consumer that it's going to cost more for this specialism, you're signaling that it's going to be worth more. I think music is commoditized pricing, and that's a bad way to go. But I think if you're telling me that if I go to the butchers and pay more for that steak, I know they've searched and looked after and, you know, cut and carved and presented that steak that much better. I will pay for that signal. So I would say to anybody in the room thinking about niche pricing, do not make the mistake of commoditizing the price point. Think of what you're doing is worth more, even though volume-wise, you're offering less. This isn't a commodity. This is culture.
Yeah. What he said.
Yeah, and just for everyone in the room, thank you both for also contributing to renewing the faith in those who don't understand music business globally. It's gone global, and we all know that. It's become almost generalized in a sense when we talk about genres. But to remember that it is a hyper-local market, and that these artists or creators should understand that, because that can really drive their metrics if they focus on those local markets. So thanks for renewing that.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Will.
Where there's a will, there's a relative.
Yes.
Where there's two wills, there's an inheritance tax dispute.
I like that one. So given the sheer number of genres and the sheer number of niches and the way that a lot of artists are combining them, it basically way more than we can really comprehend as people, I think. Do you think there would be any advantage in reframing the way we think about genres as unique IDs that are generated by an algorithm that a computer is listening through the music and saying, this is within this hierarchy, this is fits within this genre? Do you think there would be any advantage in thinking about genres in that way instead of, you know, saying, oh, this is pop that sounds kind of like metal, or, you know, that type of thing?
Can I latch this one?
Please do.
So I'll give you a great example here. So on Spotify, there's a playlist, a very successful playlist called Peaceful Piano. Now, is peaceful piano a genre? ...? It's jazz piano, it's classical piano, but it's peaceful piano. That playlist has 6.8 million listeners. And I have got people onto that playlist, and they've gone from having 200 fans on Spotify, because they're piano, it's an underrepresented genre, to having 6.8 million. But none want to know who you are, because you don't enter that genre with any intent of learning who that composition is by. You enter that genre to do your study, to complete your exams, to zone out and read. So I think there's something to be said about how you label music, good and bad, to working that one out, and you can debate that one over Malbec wine for hours. But what does that do to the intent of discovering music is the unanswered question there. So Peaceful Piano is a classic anomaly at Spotify of just, you got 6.8 million people, that's more than the population of Scotland, you got a huge audience. Nobody wants to know your name because of the way the music was presented. That's a good thing, but it's not a great thing if you want to build your career. So you need to find a different venue. And I just reiterate, every noise at once, that website will blow your friggin' mind. Like, I don't think that guy who built that gets out that often. I don't think he has a social life, but now it's now up to 5,781 genres he's coded, so take your pick.
We'll check it out. Thank you very much.
Hi. My question is, those streaming platforms have a massive audience, right? Large data. It's a very powerful distribution platform. So the question is, would love to hear your thoughts on how you think those platforms can start tackling the process of producing music as well, right? Like, they know what sells well. The same way Amazon, for example, starts building Amazon Basics because they know what sells well and they can do it at higher margins for them. So how do you think those platforms can start producing content in a way, like, you know, more on a fragmented way, using general users to create content for them and start using in their distribution platforms? Thank you.
That would be yours.
Hand apart, these questions are better than the rest of the conference combined. It's incredible. The Amazon Basics example really spins my mind. So the retailer has got first-hand knowledge of what, there's an expression in Britain, is what smelling is selling. And the retailer, this in case, the streaming platform, knows what's smelling and can therefore optimize what's selling. And it could be the use case for that music. It could be sleep music, as an example. You know, what sleep music? It takes up 8 hours of your listening on Spotify. The average listening time on Spotify would be 8 hours a week. If you engage in sleep music, well, there's 8 hours a day on top of your 8 hours a week when you're awake. So an Amazon Basics strategy might be to optimize the use case, but it's a fascinating proposition. I also think there could well be a market for stems, where people are selling the components of their songs to be remixed. Something, a company called whosample.com, a crowdsourced database of every sample in the world, is looking at doing, of just being able to buy and sell samples of music. So you're a producer, you produce someone's record. How about you also produce samples that other people can use to make their records? And there's a way I can try and arch this answer and sort of wrap it up for you, which is, when people use the hip term of creator tools, they're using it aplenty. Everything and anything is being called a creator tool right now. But I do think there's something when you look at Twitter strategy right now, which is snapping up creator tools companies left, right, and center, which is it's not for the company to say, this is how this is going to work. It's for the creator to say. So there is no strategy. I'm giving you, the producer, the tools to tell me what the strategy should be. So I see an Amazon's basics for music, but I think it will be a use case example. Very, very astute question.
I can't follow up on that answer. That's brilliant. But I think there's an inherent magic in artists creating music. And I don't think, at least till now, that the data and AI has been able to replicate that. Until they're able to create that magic, I think there will always be space for artists to be creating and doing the amazing stuff that they do.
Yeah, I can just quickly bolt on with AI. Sometimes in my book, Tarzan Economics, I call AI more artificial than intelligent. And the example I give is, if AI sees that people stand in a semicircle looking at a tragic car accident and staring at the victims, it assumes people like standing in semicircles looking at a car accident, staring at the victims. More artificial than intelligence, so it doesn't get context.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Hi, my name is David Hurley. I'm a professor at Northeastern University in Boston. And I was wondering if you could speak, I came in late, so maybe you already spoke about this, but if you can speak to the biases in these algorithms. Like, I know that a lot of the 60s rock radio had a lot of white critics writing about music, and so that music tends to have like lots and lots and lots and lots of meta tags, whereas like more contemporary music has less and less meta tags because it doesn't have that sort of rich history of radio aiming at target audiences. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about, or if you've thought about the idea of sort of white male privilege in the generation of tags, and if there's some way to systematically look at the biases that people who are creating these tags at that level, so we can actually create more diversity in the tags and to have music be more nuanced and sort of searchable in that way by addressing those biases.
That's a deep question. I think I can offer three comments on it. One, the word bias can get abused like the word diverse. That is, every person in this room would have a different definition of bias and a different definition of diverse, which is great, but if you can't agree, then what are we discussing? So that sensitive debate can get lost in translation. Two, I think you should separate out biases with regards to the creator and the consumer. So there could be a bias of music in this direction, but on the creator side, but a very different response rate from the audience side. So you have to be careful that it's a two-sided market, not a one-sided market. And then thirdly, in terms of algorithms, they're created by humans but applied naturally, so tech is not neutral. I can sense that in your question, but I can talk to the Discover Weekly algorithm because I helped work on it back in 2015. It's just a very interesting anecdote here of how do you improve your Discover Weekly? You may have remembered this if you're using Spotify 2015. Is saves going to help? Is shares going to help? Is starring songs going to help improve your algorithm? Truth of the matter is, none of that helped. The algorithm was based around people around you and what they were doing with music that was similar to yours in order to populate your 30 songs every Monday. That was very misunderstood. You had people sharing like blog posts about how to improve the algorithm on Discover Weekly, and I'm reading it thinking, you don't get it. The algorithm works outside of you, so your actions don't actually affect that algorithm. And I just offer that as an example of giving you clarity on how algorithms actually work, as opposed to people thinking they're manipulative or there's a bias from a human being involved.
Yeah, I'm not so much suggesting that they're manipulative, but just that they're a reflection of the people entering the data, that's all.
Mm-hmm. The point about, to your point on the legacy of having more signals in the metadata for older music versus new music, that's fascinating. That's something I'd actually quite happily pick up with you afterwards and see if there can be some studies done on that front. That's a fascinating point about a legacy bias.
Right, exactly. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Hi there. You mentioned that Spotify's managed to maintain a price of $9.99 a month for years now. How? And if they do develop themselves and move into different areas where they're more niche, will they still be able to provide that same price? And what will their more niche platforms do to counteract that in order to stay in business?
Fun fact for you, I'm hearing an accent there as well, I have to ask. Where are you from?
I'm from Scotland.
There you go. Population of Scotland is here today. Right, so very, very quickly on this one. Do you know where the $9.99 price point came from?
Not a clue. I signed up from a magazine, whatever, 20 years or however long ago it was.
3rd of December 2001, Rhapsody got the license to offer 15,000 songs, not 100 million songs, for $9.99. And I saw the memo from some coked up record label exec who said if it costs $9.99 to rent movies from Blockbuster Video, that's what it costs to rent music. 2001. 2022, and we are still offering 100 million songs at $9.99. Yeah, incredible. Now, the point about the Rhapsody analogy there is, why have we gone from 15,000 songs to 100 million, from no smartphone to apps and algorithmic playlists? Why do we make the product better and better and offer more and more, yet when you strip out inflation, you know, 2.3 people paying $14.99 for a family plan, that's £6.50 each, when you strip out inflation and product codes, we're offering less and less. And for the people in the room, there's a great paper I published on this called Malbeconomics. Called Malbeconomics because A, Malbec tastes amazing. B, it's a cringeable joke, Malbeconomics, everyone get that? But what I do is I show that the price of a medium glass of Malbec when Spotify launched in the UK was £4. It's now £8. So a medium glass of Malbec, which goes through your system in a matter of hours, costs more than 100 million songs ad-free on demand. And it just bugs my base bin that we seem to have got ourselves in this situation where a glass of wine costs more than all Wells' repertoire for a month.
Great. There's no way I can add to that.
Okay. Thank you.
To be discussed over Malbec immediately after this session. I think that wraps up all of our questions. I have to say, those questions were way better than our discussion, so I'm very grateful for the dialogue there. But thank you for the presentation.
And thank you. Thank you for being here. And thank you all for coming.